Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You're listening to the Mind Over Murder podcast.
My name is Bill Thomas. I'm a writer, consulting producer, and now podcaster. I am now trying to use my experience as the brother of a murder victim to help other victims of violent crime. I'm working on a book on the unsolved Colonial Parkway murders, and I'm the co-administrator of the Colonial Parkway Murders Facebook group together with Kristen Dilley.
My name is Kristen Dilley. I'm a writer, a researcher, a teacher, and a victim's advocate, as well as the social media manager and co-administrator for the Colonial Parkway Murders Facebook page with my partner in crime, Bill Thomas. Welcome to Mind Over Murder. I'm Kristen Dilley.
And I'm Bill Thomas.
And today we are covering All That Remains by Patricia Cornwell, the fiction book about the Colonial Parkway murders case that's not really about the Colonial Parkway murders case, but it might be about the Colonial Parkway murders case. Is that oblique enough?
I thought you were going to say the allegedly fictional book, All That Remains.
Maybe we need to consult with our legal department on some of this wording. What do you think?
We're in trouble already and we just got started.
I know.
By the way, before we get started, you sound very chipper for a teacher who's back getting up at oh dark 30 and teaching again. How's it going?
I'm tired.
But it's going great,
right? You ask any teacher how the first week of school goes and they're going to tell you, I'm tired. All the time.
Have you acclimated to getting up at 4:30 in the morning again?
No, there is no way to acclimate to that. I will remain tired all year.
You have my sympathy. You really do.
Yes, I should. But no, seriously, though, folks, it is really good to be back in the classroom with children in the building, although it is a little scary the first time that I was in the room with 30 kids in the room going, I have not been in this room this crowded since the pandemic started.
Are they wearing masks?
All of them are wearing masks. They have been very good about staying masked up.
And are you wearing a mask?
I am wearing a mask. There is a mask mandate in place. Yes.
Does yours say teacher on it or silence or anything strict like that?
No, but now that you said it, I should. No. I think a silence one would be great.
That would be awfully strict, don't you think?
We do have Mind Over Murder masks that you can get at T-Public.
That is true. I hadn't thought about a Mind Over Murder mask.
I feel like maybe it's probably not a great idea for me to advertise my podcast in my classroom.
Probably not a good idea.
I might get one anyway, just because.
We didn't have to run that one past legal. We just knew.
We did it. We nailed it. I do have an oxygen mask that I've been wearing that says oxygen that you brought me from CrimeCon. So I've been wearing that one.
Those are pretty snazzy. And by the way, before anybody starts sending us odd mail, which we do appreciate, we love hearing from everybody. We don't really have a legal department.
No.
We know some very good attorneys, but we try not to call them because they always want to bill us for the time.
Yeah, we can't really afford to have a legal department at this point.
Let's not get in any legal trouble either.
Yeah, that's not a great idea.
And with all
please don't sue me. I don't have any money.
With all of that in mind, I guess we should get started.
We should. For those of y'all that are familiar with the case, you are probably familiar with the fact that Patricia Cornwell, a Richmond novelist, she no longer lives in Richmond now, but did at the time, wrote a book called All That Remains. And All That Remains was published in 1992, which is a couple of years after the final murder in the Colonial Parkway murder series, definitely at a time when the case was still in the media. All That Remains was the third novel in her extraordinarily popular Kay Scarpetta series, which is still going to this day. And in fact, she is about to publish her 25th Kay Scarpetta novel in November.
I mentioned to you when we were preparing a little earlier that the expression cranking them out comes to mind here.
It does.
That's amazing.
It does. She's not as prolific as James Patterson.
Or Stephen King, for that matter.
But 25 novels in the Kay Scarpetta series is pretty awesome. And she has had assorted other books. Anyone familiar with Patricia Cornwell will also know that she did do an investigation into Jack the Ripper. She felt that she did determine the identity of Jack the Ripper. I don't think there's agreement on either side of the Atlantic as to whether or not her candidate is Jack the Ripper, but she got a book out of it.
And she's been putting out books for over 30 years. And as I mentioned to you, she has put out about a book a year for 30 years in a row, which is something to be admired. She definitely works hard at it and has had a significant amount of success as an author.
She does do a ton of research. I follow her on Facebook, like I follow half the world on Facebook. And she is always putting up pictures of going to the FBI Academy, working at the medical examiner's office. She knows how to fly helicopters. She knows how to scuba dive. She knows how to shoot guns. Anything that Kay Scarpetta knows how to do, Patricia Cornwell learned how to do first for authenticity. So I will give her the fact that she is extraordinarily well-researched.
I didn't know she flew helicopters.
Yeah, she did. In fact, her author picture for a while was her in the cockpit of her own helicopter.
Helicopters, by the way, are incredibly complicated and difficult to fly. I have two nephews, James and Ross, both of whom are Navy helicopter pilots. It is much more difficult to fly a helicopter than it is to fly a fixed-wing aircraft. I've had a chance to sit in some of their helicopters, but unfortunately, as a civilian, I'm not allowed to go up in their helicopters while they're flying them around. It's a government aircraft and all that kind of good stuff. Kudos to Patricia Cornwell for learning how to fly a helicopter. It's not easy, as I understand it.
Yeah, I can't imagine that it would be. One of the things that Cornwell did do to prepare for her work as an author of a massively best-selling series was she did work for the Richmond Medical Examiner's Office. And she worked under Dr. Marcella Fierro, who I believe you know, Mr. Thomas.
Yes.
And she worked at the Medical Examiner's Office from 1985 to 1992. She held two positions. She was a technical writer and she was a computer analyst.
And Marcella Fierro was Patricia Cornwell's boss, as we understand it.
Yes.
Dr. Fierro is the real-life inspiration for the Kay Scarpetta character, hence the similar, beautiful Italian-sounding last name.
Yeah, that's my understanding of it. In addition to working at the medical examiner's office, she did volunteer with Richmond PD, going along on ride-alongs. So again, more with that research, she really dug in there to learn all the different aspects of law enforcement. And her first novel, which was called Postmortem and won like every major mystery writing award that it could win, was actually based on another series of Virginia serial killings, the Southside Strangler murders, which were committed in Richmond during 1987. And we'll go ahead and plug for our good friend Richard Foster. If you are interested in the Southside Strangler murders, do listen to his podcast, Southern Nightmare. It will give you nightmares. It is wonderful.
And he has a very good book by the same name.
All That Remains is, like we were saying at the top of the pod, she's never come out and said, this is about the Colonial Parkway murders. But it's pretty clear once you read it that it is heavily based on the Colonial Parkway murder. Is that an accurate assessment, Bill? Have I said that correctly?
And that was my primary takeaway when I read the book. I think I've mentioned that it had come up a number of times in conversation, this is some years back now, that All That Remains was based on the Colonial Parkway murders. I wasn't really certain about that until I finally, after just rolling my eyes for several years, went out and bought a used copy of the book for 75 cents online, plus shipping, and read the book. My single greatest takeaway is that this isn't based on the Colonial Parkway murders. This is the Colonial Parkway murders, particularly, and I know you want to get into some detail here, particularly the Phelps-Lauer incident, which is incident number 4 in the Colonial Parkway murders. The descriptions and details are incredibly close.
And because we have had people ask us fairly recently on our social media pages, are you guys going to talk about All That Remains? We figured, yeah, we'll talk about All That Remains. We'll do that. This is certainly a discussion that is lengthy enough that it will very likely take 2 episodes. We would encourage you, if you have not read the book, go read the book. You could do it in between this first episode and the second one following it, or you can just take our word for it. But I would recommend reading the book and weighing in with us on social media about your thoughts on All That Remains.
We're not here, by the way, to shill and push sales of this book. I would make a note that every public library in America probably has a copy of All That Remains.
Oh, yeah.
Go to your public library, borrow the book, take it out. We're not pushing to increase Patricia Cornwell's sales of this or any other book. I thought it was well worth the 75 cents I paid for it, but you don't even have to buy a used copy of the book. You could just borrow it from your local public library.
I'm sure they actually do have a pretty massive Patricia Cornwell section. Mine certainly does.
Yeah, they're very popular, and I get it, and they're interesting and fun to read. But you don't have to go out and buy 30 copies of every single one of her novels.
She's also not paying us to promote her books, so that's not what we're trying to do. But as an English teacher, I think it's important that everyone does their research. So if you are interested in what we have to say during this episode or next, go check it out from the local library, as Thomas suggested.
I'm lucky enough to live 2 doors down from
an
incredible library here in our small town. And I love seeing my friends over at the library. And I know they like seeing us wander in. And they even let Oliver the Dachshund in there.
Oh,
he's not much of a reader, but he is a well-known personality around town.
We'll go ahead and jump into All That Remains. And what we'll do to open the discussion, we'll just go chapter by chapter, give a little brief summary of what precisely goes on in that chapter. And then we will unpack the similarities and the differences between the Colonial Parkway murders and the murders that she dubs the couple's killings in the novel. Ready, Bill?
Yes. One other thing. I was tempted to ring a bell every time we found a similarity between real life and this allegedly fictional book, but I think that might be a little bit too much. But I was thinking about having, ding, another coincidence.
Might be a little too on the nose.
Okay.
So the novel actually opens, getting into the action, with Dr. Kay Scarpetta, the chief medical examiner of Virginia, learning about the disappearance of 2 19-year-olds, Deborah Harvey and Fred Cheney, over Labor Day weekend. Mm. Ding, there's our first comparison. She learns that an abandoned car has been found at the New Kent County rest stop on I-64, and she rushes out there to view it while it is in situ.
Ding. Promise to stop.
It is established as she is rushing out to this potential crime scene that there have been 4 other murders of couples prior to this missing couple. So it's established right away. There is a serial killer. He or she, but mainly he, is abducting couples, and this is the 5th set of victims. So she does change things a little bit.
A little.
A little. We learn from Scarpetta that the victims in this case are pretty similar to our victims in real life, Anna Maria Phelps and Daniel Lauer. The victims in this fictional case are a young man and a young woman traveling together from Richmond, in real life, Amelia County, toward a beach town called Spindrift, in real life, Virginia Beach.
Is there a real place called Spindrift, Virginia?
Honestly, I'm not sure.
We'll have to check that out.
Yeah. The ages are incorrect. Anna Maria and Daniel were 18 and 21, respectively, at the time of their disappearance. But the characters, Deborah Harvey and Fred Cheney, are 19. Also, for the purposes of the novel, Deborah Harvey is made the daughter of a prominent politician. This is an actual political role known as, it's known colloquially as the drug czar. And so she is made the daughter of Pat Harvey, who is a presidential appointee overseeing like the drug enforcement agencies, the drug czar, essentially. And we know, of course, that is not true.
Oh, one quick thing. I just did some quick research in real time. Spindrift is not a town in Virginia, but it is a location in Virginia Beach. It's a road, a Spindrift Road in Virginia Beach, which is off Long Creek.
There's one bit of research that I was not able to do for myself at that point. So I'm glad you were able to fill in the gap there.
The wonders of internet search.
Seriously, right? We know that in real life, we have discussed this a number of times, that Anna Maria and Daniel were not a couple. Anna Maria was dating Clint Lauer. Daniel was just going to live with them to help with expenses and rent and so on and so forth. So in real life, we do not have two people who are a couple. They just happen to be traveling together at the same point with the same destination in mind. In the book, Deborah Harvey and Fred Chaney are an actual couple. Now, here's the point where I think we can both reasonably understand why the Phelps family and the Lauer family reacted rather strongly to the book when the book came out. Is that a fair assessment?
It is, as I understand it, from talking to the Phelps and Lauer families over the years.
The description of the Deborah Harvey and Fred Chaney crime scene bears remarkable, maybe even uncanny resemblance to the Phelps Lauer crime scene at the New Kent rest stop. The location of the car is the same on the acceleration lane. The description of the rest stop is dead on accurate, including the split lanes where you go to the front of the building or the back of the building. The things that were not accurate are the make and model of the car. She gives Deborah Harvey a Jeep, whereas we know Daniel had a Chevy Nova. And the contents of the car are, of course, different. We know Daniel was moving down to Virginia Beach, so he had his worldly possessions with him, whereas fictional couple was carrying things that you would expect for a beach weekend. So cooler, luggage, slalom ski. Also not mentioned in the book is that roach clip that was found on the driver's side window of Daniel's car when it was located at the rest stop.
Let's not move past something too quickly, though. The car is also found in the book on the eastbound side of the rest stop. So this whole thing we've discussed before with Anna Maria and Daniel's car being found traveling in the wrong direction, that whole transference from one rest stop to the other rest stop on the other side of the highway seems to be key as well in the book.
Yes, very much. Now, the one question that I did have that I cannot answer, but I know that you can with regard to this crime scene. In the book, a dog team from Peninsula Search and Rescue are called in to scent the car and see if they can find Deborah and Fred. Do we know if Peninsula Search and Rescue was ever called in to the Phelps-Lauer crime scene?
I can't say with 100% assuredness that they scented the car, but I know that an extensive search was conducted by Virginia State Police and by agencies like Peninsula Search and Rescue. So I think it's a qualified yes. I also know that they did flyovers with Virginia State Police planes. Unfortunately, as we've discussed, the leaves were still fully leafed out in that Labor Day to October timeframe. So the flyovers themselves were not successful, but a fair amount of searching was done and agencies like Peninsula Search and Rescue were used.
Here we are when we're recording this, it's before Labor Day weekend. So we're actually approaching the anniversary for Anna Maria Phelps and Daniel Lauer's disappearance. And I can definitely tell you that there are full leaves on the trees. There is no color to be seen. Like it's still looking and feeling like summer out here. And so that wraps up the first chapter of the book. And already you can see that there are a number of similarities between this fictionalized crime scene and the actual real life crime scene in which Anna Maria Phelps and Daniel Lauer's car was found at the New Kent County rest stop. Bill, any color commentary you'd like to add at this point, or shall we move forward?
No, just that when I read the book some years ago now, this was my first takeaway, was just, wow, this detail is so close. And of course, I knew a fair amount about the Phelps Lower crime scene and had seen the crime scene photos, which had been leaked by the FBI. The similarities are very striking between what is supposed to be a work of fiction and what we know is the real life scenario for the Colonial Parkway murders.
And it was very interesting to me as I read that as we get into chapter two, where Kay Scarpetta does discuss in exposition about the other cases in this series, it was very interesting to me that she went to great lengths to make the other cases in the series nothing like their real life counterparts. And yet that first crime scene is so close to real life. That's what really jumped out to me.
And for me as well.
So in chapter two, we do get that moniker, the couple killings. Bill, I think I remember you telling me once, but boy, I can't remember it now for the life of me. At what point did the name Colonial Parkway Murders start coming into use? Would it have been during this time period? Late 90s, maybe? Yeah.
Oh, certainly. Absolutely.
Okay. Just curious.
Our research shows the Colonial Parkway murders as an expression comes out of media coverage, but certainly by the very late 80s, early 90s, local media, television, radio, newspapers are referring to the four double homicides as the Colonial Parkway murders. Even though, as we have explained, only two of the cases actually have a direct relationship to the Colonial Parkway, nonetheless, that was what the media dubbed the Colonial Parkway murders. You're listening to Mind Over Murder. We'll be right back after this word from our sponsors.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We're back here at Mind Over Murder.
So in this, Cornwell dubs it the couple killings, and it does list a discrepancy of 10 victims instead of 8 victims. And later on in the novel, we learn that there are another 2 victims to add to that. So the number is actually much higher. She takes this chapter to really discuss all of the other cases in this series, and those only have the barest passing commonalities to the real cases. Cornwell offers a summary of the other cases in her couple's killings. And as I mentioned, they only have passing commonalities with their real life counterparts, if we are to assume that she is drawing those comparisons to the Colonial Parkway murders. She lists characters who have disappeared, Bruce Phillips and Judy Roberts, who are high school sweethearts, who disappeared on June 1st in Gloucester and never arrived at their homes. Bruce's Camaro was found off 17 with keys in the ignition, doors unlocked, windows rolled down, and their bodies found in the York River State Park 10 weeks later. There is no real resemblance to any of the real cases description.
I'm going to push back lightly here.
Okay.
I actually see a lot of parallels, but okay. What I believe Patricia Cornwell has done is mixed up the details.
All right, I got
keys in the ignition, doors unlocked, windows rolled down, even the 10-week time frame.
Okay.
This is a little bit of a mixmaster thing going on here with a little bit of each of the real-life Colonial Parkway murders details, but then swapped case to case. I think you'll get more of what I'm talking about in a minute.
I see what you mean. Yeah, exactly. I was being a little too literal, I think, with my analysis, but you're right. She lists the second couple to have disappeared as Jim Freeman and Bonnie Smith, who disappeared the final Saturday in July after a pool party in Providence Forge. Jim's blazer was found 10 miles from Providence Forge, and their bodies were found in West Point 4 months later. Third couple is listed as Ben Anderson and Carolyn Bennett, driving back to ODU from Stingray Point on the Chesapeake Bay in March of the following year. His pickup truck, Dodge pickup, was found abandoned on Interstate 64, 5 miles east of Buckrow Beach, with keys in the ignition, doors unlocked, and Carolyn's pocketbook under the seat. Their bodies were discovered 6 months later in York County off of Route 199. And then finally, the last of the cases that she invents, Susan Wilcox and Mike Martin, who disappeared on the way to Virginia Beach for spring break, which I found a little odd because she lists them as having disappeared in February, and we definitely don't have spring break in February.
For high school or college.
Yeah. Mike's blue van was found on the Colonial Parkway. This is the only mention of the Colonial Parkway thus far. A white handkerchief signaling engine trouble that did not exist was attached to the antenna, and their bodies were found on May 15th by turkey hunters in a wooded area of James City County between Route 60 and Interstate 64. And I think you looked it up, and that isn't the right time frame for turkey hunting, am I right?
It is not the right time for turkey hunting.
So there are some similarities, as you did point out rightfully. I think I was definitely in the wrong on this one, that there are similarities between the fictional cases and their real counterparts. There are victims from Gloucester, Keith Call. There are victims leaving a party who never arrived at their destination. Again, Keith and Sandy. There are victims going to Virginia Beach, victims whose cars were found on the Colonial Parkway, and victims whose bodies were found by turkey hunters. But the bulk of those cases that she lays out seem to be fairly well obfuscated and separate from their actual real-life counterparts. Later in the novel, it is revealed that there was a first set of victims. And it is revealed that that first set of victims was a lesbian couple named Jill Harrington and Elizabeth Mott. And those characters do very closely resemble Kathy Thomas and Rebecca Dowski.
I think at this point, we're way past coincidence here. Some of the details are shifted around, but as you pointed out a moment ago, there's a lot of similarities. And then for me personally, reading the book, when I got to the place where the lesbian couple showed up, I said, wait a minute, this is clearly the Colonial Parkway murders.
Here's where things also got a little bit mixed up for me when I first read the book. When I first read Patricia Cornwell's All That Remains, I was probably too young to be reading it. I was like, and it was actually my first exposure to the case outside of some news reporting. Keep in mind, at 11, I was not like regularly consuming the newspaper. And when the first case actually happened, when your sister's case actually happened, I was too young to have a real understanding of what was actually happening. I won't even say how old I actually was.
Just a tiny child.
So Patricia Cornwell's book, All That Remains, was really my first in-depth introduction to the concept of the Colonial Parkway murders. And so it was confusing to me when I first started doing real research on the case, when I realized, wait, that's not what it said in the book. I so very clearly thought that the book hewed really closely to the facts of the case, and I thought that what she had written about was going to be similar to what was reported. So it was confusing for me and my poor little adult 11-year-old brain, who should not have been reading books this mature, like at all,
and see what
the actual facts of the case were.
See what happens when you end up reading books that are too sophisticated for young minds? You end up being the host of a true crime podcast and discussing horrible things.
I fully blame Patricia Cornwell, John Douglas, and Mark Olshaker for this. I was reading John Douglas and Mark Olshaker's books way sooner than I should have as well. You want to talk messing up a 14-year-old? There you go.
Let this be a warning to all of us as parents. This is where they go bad.
No, in all seriousness, we love John. We love Mark. They are wonderful people and we love their work, but probably should not have been reading it at 14. That's just me. Sheltered and impressionable youth. Shouldn't have been reading about serial killers that young.
Exactly. Ended up with a dark and twisted mind.
It's sad how that happens, isn't it? Really, question I think that I came away from after reading this chapter is how someone who... I find it very striking that the other couples that she lists are so dissimilar to the rest of the Colonial Parkway murders cases, but the Harvey Chaney scene is so similar to the actual facts of the Phelps-Lauer case. There was a real disconnect there for me. for someone who went to such great lengths to fictionalize the other double homicides in this series, she hewed really close to real life in the case that's the central focus of the book. I had a little bit of cognitive dissonance there as I'm sitting here writing my notes and processing all of this.
I think that it's just a matter of mixing up some of the details in some of the other murders, which are a bit secondary, respectfully. But in terms of the storytelling that she's chosen, she goes into much more depth on the last of the murder series, which is the one that's so close to Phelps Lauer. It's hard not to think that, I wonder, could she have had access to the Phelps Lauer files? Could she have made a field trip to these locations?
We're guilty of field trips, dude. Just saying.
Yes, but we're not presenting work as fiction.
It's true.
That feels like it's a nonfictional account of a real life case. I'm not accusing anyone of anything, but it's hard not to wonder if an author who had access to the computers, that was one of her jobs at the medical examiner's office, and to be a technical writer, which may have involved writing up the descriptions of these cases or having access to the description of these cases. It's hard not to think that the reason this is so strikingly similar is that it's so strikingly similar. You can't really get around it.
And we do see more really striking similarities in further chapters of the novel. Certainly, it seems like the Phelps and Lauer families looked at the novel and felt the same way that you did. This is really strikingly similar.
Agreed.
So in the third chapter of the book, you get more of the procedural aspect of the thing. Remember, Kay Scarpetta is a medical examiner, and so she does do her part in trying to help solve the case. So she has various meetings with her detective sidekick, Pete Marino, and her friend, Benton Wesley, who is a profiler with the FBI, who she goes on to marry several books later. She also meets with a Washington Post reporter who happens to have had a sister who was murdered by the character that was based on Timothy Spencer, the Richmond's Southside Strangler. In chapter three, she goes into a little bit more detail about the couple's killings. And she does give it a much shorter time frame than they had in real life.
The difference between 2.5 and 3 years? Not sure I agree.
She does state that they've been going on for 2.5 years. Although, as you pointed out, Bill, there are times when I forget that the timeline is a lot shorter than I think that it is. I tend to think 4 years.
I think we all do that. And I've done it too. Because the cases took place in 86, 87, 88, and 89, we have a tendency to say 4 years.
4 years.
When you look at a calendar, however, the first murder in the Colonial Parkway murders, Kathy and Becky, is October 1986. The final murder that we attribute to this series we call the Colonial Parkway murders is Anna Maria Phelps and Daniel Lauer in September 1989. That's barely 3 years.
Okay.
I know we often say four.
Because, my math-addled brain is the one that says four.
Because we say 86, 87, 88, 89, but it's actually a three-year period.
That's why I'm an English teacher, not a math teacher.
And this is also one of the reasons why people have brought up various ideas regarding the Colonial Parkway murders. For instance, 3 years can line up with military tours, and we know there's a tremendous amount of military in the peninsula area. And this is also within a typical four-year span for a college student. So, for example, a William and Mary student or Christopher Newport University or any of the other schools and universities in the area, typically you'd be there for 4 years if you were attending a four-year undergraduate program.
Now, she uses this chapter to lay out, via her detective and profiler friends, some of the common theories. The common theories as to who done it. These are definitely some of the theories that we have talked about here on the podcast. And there are also some that are a bit more off the wall that we have not really given a ton of consideration to. So Pete Marino, the Richmond detective, does bring up this theory of an anger excitation offender. He says, it still strikes me as the work of some squirrel out there who fixes on couples, a jealousy type thing because he's a loser, can't have a relationship, and hates other people who can. In fact, it was our resident profiler. I shouldn't say he's our profiler, but feel a little proprietary interest in Jim Clemente. Jim has mentioned that concept before, has he not?
He has. And then continue Benton Wesley, the FBI profiler's theory, which is also something that Jim Clemente, a real-life FBI profiler, has mentioned.
Yes, the killer cop theory. It could be someone posing as a cop. Certainly, that would account for the couples pulling over and perhaps getting into someone else's car for a routine license check or whatever. Anyone can walk into a uniform store and buy a bubble light, a gun, a badge, you name it.
In the Lover's Lane series, Jim Clemente demonstrated how an organized, somewhat aggressive offender posing as law enforcement, with law enforcement training or without, could approach a couple and control them and separate them, much in the way that we saw in the real-life Colonial Parkway murders. So it's interesting that Cornwall is talking about these two theories, both of which have come up with our real-life profilers as well.
Now, she does bring up a third theory, one of which I know many people, particularly, especially locals, because they find it interesting, though I find it a little hard to take it all that seriously. And that is the Camp Perry theory. For anyone who is not aware, so that would be anyone who's not local, there is a government installation. It's a secret government installation. I'm using air quotes around secrets because anyone who's local knows that it's here, called Camp Perry. And Camp Perry is the CIA's main training base. Hopefully the CIA is not going to rappel off my roof from black helicopters for me saying that.
Probably not.
I don't know. If you hear a thud, that might be what's going on. May have black ops on my roof.
Tell us the theory.
It is a theory and it's an interesting theory, but she does bring up the idea that maybe the killer is a rogue CIA agent practicing killing people, who's been stationed at Camp Perry. And while that may seem eye-rollingly, oh, please, there are a number of people who I have talked to locally about the case who are like, I think it was a rogue Camp Perry agent. And I am pretty sure that would not even be on anyone's radar if it were not for All That Remains.
Oh, I think actually Cornwell is responsible for this theory taking hold. There's a variation on this theory, too, which is that in the 1980s, the CIA was training a lot of agents from around the world, and may still do for all we know. The idea that some of these agents might have left Camp Perry and wanted to try out some of their techniques on an unsuspecting public could extend to international people who would maybe feel less of an obligation to respect the laws of the United States and go out and go rogue. At least that's the 3A and 3B theory.
Yeah.
And so B meaning, oh, now we've got people from South America who are being trained, think Contras and others, by the United States government in exchange for a buck, I'm sure, and that these people would then go out and go rogue.
It's really important to note that there has never been any evidence that we are aware of, keeping in mind that we don't know everything and the FBI certainly doesn't tell us its business. There has never been any evidence that we're aware of that anyone from Camp Perry might be involved in these cases.
That is true.
The cases on the parkway itself are the only two that are even remotely close to Camp Perry. And if you want to actually get really technical about it, the closest military installation to where Kathy and Keith's cars were found is the Navy's Cheatham Annex. Camp Perry isn't closer. The Annex is.
The Annex, actually, Cheatham Annex, which is a very large fenced-in facility, immediately adjoins the one area where we think it's quite possible that Kathy and Becky went to, which is the Ringfield Plantation. And as I understand it, directly from the FBI back then, confirmed in later conversations, they actually searched inside and outside the Cheatham Annex perimeter fence just on the possibility that a knife that might have been used or other weapons in Kathy and Becky's murder could have been tossed over the fence into the woods surrounding the naval facility. There are military installations all over this area, and they are immediately adjacent, and I'm talking about yards away from several of these crime scenes.
We do get some additional information about the cases. Scarpetta asserts that all the bodies in all the cases have been found in the woods, decomposed. We know that in real life, that is not true. It is only true of the Phelps and Lauer case. Robin and David were found in the water. Kathy and Becky were found in Kathy's car. And as we know, Keith and Sandy have never been recovered. I think she tried to streamline her, maybe neaten up the fictional series of killings. Scarpetta, as the medical examiner, also states that she has been unable to determine a cause of death in any of the cases. Again, we know that is not necessarily true. In real life, there was a cause of death that was able to be determined for Kathy and Becky and for Robin and David. As always, Keith and Sandy are the wild card because we have never located them. But it is true that Anna Maria and Daniel's bodies were too decomposed for a cause of death. There was a knife slice found on Anna Maria's hand. So ultimately, it was ruled that she was very likely stabbed to death. But there was no cause of death listed for Daniel Lauer other than homicide, because his body was too badly skeletonized for there to be any determination of what could have happened to him.
This leads us, though, to another one of those coincidences, which is the examination of the knife wounds.
Yeah, it was always very interesting to me that the Smithsonian Institute, this is again news for anybody who may not be aware of it or may not have watched the TV show Bones. The Smithsonian Institute actually has a whole section where you can send human remains or animal remains, any type that is unknown, for examination. And so Anna Maria and Daniel were actually sent to the Smithsonian Institute to have someone take a look at the knife slice that was found on Anna Maria's index finger, her left index finger. That is another interesting touch that happened in real life, but then also does appear in the book. In fact, there is a whole chapter in which Kay Scarpetta packs up the bodies of Deborah Harvey and Fred Chaney and takes them with her to Washington, D.C., so that she can visit the Smithsonian Institute and get some clarity on what may have caused the nick mark on the bone on Deborah's hand. I almost called her Anna Maria.
And this is precisely the request that the real-life Dr. Marcello Fierro made of the Smithsonian. The remains were skeletal at this point, and so there was a bit of clothing, the skulls and skeletons left on the forest floor under the blanket, as we've discussed. Those things were packed up and brought to the Smithsonian. So the book once again strongly paralleled the real life experience of the Colonial Parkway murders.
We're going to continue our close analysis and dissection, pun definitely not intended until I said it, and now it is intended, of All That Remains by Patricia Cornwell. And we're going to continue that comparison between the book and the actual case itself in our next episode. And I don't know, maybe the episode after that. What do you think, Bill?
We'll let it play out.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Mind Over Murder. We'll see you next time.
Mind Over Murder is a production of Absolute Zero and Another Dog Productions.
Our executive producers are Bill Thomas and Kristen Dilley.
Our logo art is by Pamela Arnois.
Our theme music is by Kevin MacLeod.
Mind Over Murder is distributed in partnership with Crawl Space Media.
You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.
You can also follow our page on the Colonial Parkway Murders on Facebook.
And finally, you can follow Bill Thomas on Twitter at BillThomas56.
Thank you for listening to Mind Over Murder. Thank you.